Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
I'm Grace Bonney of After the Jump, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Native on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Brianna Kurtz. Each week, this show features a U.S. or international location and uses food and drink as a gateway to explore and celebrate the gastronomic virtues of a destination. Part travel show, part current affairs, Native recognizes the fact that food culture and commerce are everywhere and takes the opportunity to examine these subjects by using the eyes, ears, and taste buds of farmers, chefs, journalists, and the like. This week, I am joined by Fuchsia Dunlop to talk about China, something she knows just a little bit about. Fuchsia is the winner of two 2014 James Beard Writing Awards, one for her Lucky Peach article about dick soup, and another for her latest book, Every Grain of Rice, Simple Chinese Home Cooking. And I've said it before, and I'll say it again, she is the author of the best food memoir I've ever had the pleasure of reading, Shark's Fin and Szechuan Pepper, a sweet-sour memoir of eating in China. So without further ado, hello, Fuchsia, welcome.
Hi, hello.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure.
So let's just set the record straight. I think it's pretty obvious based on your accent that you are not Chinese. You are from the UK.
Yeah, no, I grew up in Oxford, England, and now I live in London. But I do travel quite often to China.
Absolutely. Well, and your career and your adventures there span over two decades now. So tell me a little bit about what drew you to China in the first place.
Well, it was really an accident of my career. I had a job as a sub-editor for an obscure part of the BBC, where I was sub-editing, basically correcting the English of large chunks of sort of news reports about China and about the Asia-Pacific region. And I got very interested, so I went to China on holiday and was completely fascinated. So I came back and enrolled in Mandarin evening classes. And then, to cut a long story short, ended up winning a British Council scholarship to study in China for a year. And I chose Sichuan University in Chengdu, right in the heart of China, partly because I'd had a really good lunch there the year before, and I knew Sichuan was famous for its cuisine, and also because I didn't really want to be a typical expat living in Beijing and Shanghai, and I really wanted to dive into China.
And you did, like you said, you ended up in Chengdu, which is pretty far west in China, closer to Tibet, really, than Beijing. So what really defines the landscapes in terms of topography and in the cuisine?
Well, it's a long way from the capital, Beijing, and it's surrounded by mountains, which is why in the past they used to say that the road to Sichuan was more difficult than the road to heaven. So it has a very distinctive culture with its own dialect and its own cuisine. And as you've just said, if you go further west than Sichuan, you're actually in Tibet. And in fact, half of Sichuan province is the Tibetan Plateau, and it's culturally Tibetan. So when we talk about Sichuanese cuisine, it's really the cuisine of the Chengdu Basin, which is one of the richest agricultural regions of China. In fact, it's known historically as Tianfu Zhiguo, land of plenty. So it has a very favorable climate with plenty of rain and wonderful produce all year round. So it's really has a fantastic basis for cooking and eating. And of course, the most famous characteristic of Sichuanese cuisine is its fiery spiciness, coming from chilies in all different forms, sort of fresh, pickled, dried, in oil, in chili bean paste. And also for the what they call ma, the tingling, numbing sensation of Sichuan pepper. So those are the two sort of key spices of Sichuanese cooking. And according to local law, you have to eat these kind of drying, heating spices to combat the dampness of the climate. Sichuan is very gray and humid, both in summer and winter, terribly hot in the summer. So the diet is seen as being particularly suited to the climate.
Very interesting. And, you know, your adventure there started back in the early 90s, if I remember correctly from your memoir. And what has changed in that region, in Sichuan, since you first began your travels there?
Well, Chengdu, the city I lived in, is almost unrecognizable. When I went to study there in 1994, most of the city was a sort of maze of old lanes of wooden houses, with a kind of street life that, you know, with things that had been, you know, you could have seen in China for the past sort of 800 years. So there would be lots of little tea houses and restaurants and dumpling shops and little breweries making rice wine, people with duck roasting ovens, clay ovens, hanging up the roast duck inside, and sort of fresh markets selling fresh produce in every neighborhood. And that whole city, more or less, has been demolished and replaced by sort of modern architecture and so on. So, yeah, the city, I mean, apart from a few parks and temples, the city is more or less unrecognizable. And also in terms of food, I suppose that there's been, you know, since China's great drive for economic development and reform, there's been a lot of mixing of different regional cuisines. So when I first lived there, most restaurants served something that you would generally think of as being Sichuanese cuisine, all those classic dishes, you know, gongbao chicken, fish fragrant eggplant, dandan noodles. And now on a lot of Sichuan menus, you'll see dishes from Hunan, dishes from Zhejiang province, and also even kind of quite westernized dishes. Like I went to a feast in a Sichuanese restaurant a year or two ago, and one of the courses was salmon steaks, each one with a fried egg on top, served with a knife and fork. So that would never have happened when I first lived there.
And is there any kind of lamenting of this or any craving for nostalgia of the Chengdu that you knew about 20 years ago?
Well, I think some people, you know, people who are particularly involved in culture do lament the loss of the individuality of the city. But I think for many people, they've seen living standards improve and the old houses realistically were not comfortable to live in. Mm-hmm. So I think there's some regret. But I think it's mainly sort of nostalgic foreigners like me, a lot of it.
Yeah, but it's not so easily black and white. There's a lot of gray area there with balancing the the economic development with the past.
Yeah, and although the city has changed sort of superficially a lot, there are moments when, you know, I find a little tea house, impromptu tea house, someone set up by a waterway, and they put a few bamboo chairs and tables, and there are people there drinking jasmine blossom tea, playing mahjong, and lazily chatting in the wonderful Sichuan dialect. And then I really, you know, have a sense that the city hasn't changed in some fundamental ways.
Well, kind of zooming back out and looking at China as a whole, can you really say, do you think there's such thing as Chinese food, Chinese cuisine?
Well, I mean, you can generalize about it very usefully, and Chinese people do all the time. They talk about Zhongtan, Chinese cuisine, you know, in contrast to Xitan, Western cuisine. And there are, you know, you can make useful generalizations about the use of chopsticks and the importance of soy sauce and other fermented seasonings and the way that food is cut up into little pieces and so on. And that's, you know, there are certain commonalities, but the most important thing is not to let the idea of Chinese cuisine obscure the fact that China is really more like a continent than a country, and that a single Chinese province is about the size often of a European country. And it's extraordinarily diverse in terms of food. So, you know, if you had dinner one night in Xi'an in northwest China and then the next night in Shanghai, it's like going to another country gastronomically.
And in your book, you say that it's all very well to learn to cook in China, but it's equally important to learn to eat. So what does it mean to eat in Chinese?
Well, I suppose to set aside your own cultural preconceptions and try and eat from a Chinese point of view. There are quite a few Chinese ingredients that Westerners tend to find rather alien or even disgusting. And I suppose for me, one of the most important things in really getting to know Chinese cuisine was to sort of set aside these prejudices and try things from a Chinese point of view. And most importantly, I think, to get the idea that texture and mouthfeel is incredibly important in Chinese cuisine, and it's this whole extra dimension of gastronomy. So there are many ingredients in Chinese cooking, from the high-end things like bird's nest and sea cucumbers to the sort of Sichuan hot pot end when you have things like ox tripe and goose intestines, which are really baffling from the point of view of Western gastronomy because they don't have any flavor at all. They have textures that are often rather revolting from a Western point of view, sort of slithery, snappy, rubbery, springy, these textures that people don't tend to like in the West. And so...
Well, that's a great segue to we've looked at how China's changed in the past couple of decades. But what about eaters of Chinese food? As the country opens up more to the West on development terms and economically, have eaters also opened up their palates and their curiosity to enjoying some maybe those more foreign ingredients and textures?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the texture thing is a bit of a leap. And I think you first have to realize, you have to sort of, in my experience, deliberately try to see that Chinese people are really enjoying these things for the textural sensation and then try and get it yourself. But I think definitely, I mean, when I started looking at Chinese food, for example, pretty much all the Chinese food in Britain was just Cantonese, sort of anglicized Cantonese, and that was what most people thought of as Chinese food. But now, with the opening up of China and a whole new pattern of immigration, people are getting used to the spicy, many-layered flavors of Sichuan, for example, and lots of different kinds of dishes that they wouldn't previously have considered Chinese. And I think also that when Westerners visit China now, they're just amazed. I'm leading tours now to China, and I take people who are often, you know, some of them chefs and food professionals, and they are just amazed at the variety and sophistication and creativity of Chinese cuisine. And I think if you go to China and you just see that this is probably the world's most amazing culinary culture, and you go to beautiful restaurants, and it's much easier to appreciate things in that context.
Well, you wrote an amazing piece in the Financial Times in August, and you do say, and I'll quote it, that Chinese cuisine is the ghost at the feast of global gastronomy. And I think that's kind of what you were referring to, that there's still so much to be discovered. But, and I guess I'll pull something from your book, too, that I think is pretty provocative, coming from a provocative chef. Ferran Adria said that Mao Zedong was the most important political figure in the last half century in cooking. If you could maybe elaborate a little bit on what he meant by that and how the political history of China has helped shape the cuisine and also what direction we're kind of going in.
Yeah, well, what Ferran Adria said was that, yes, Mao Zedong was so important because he wrecked Chinese gastronomy for several decades. And if he hadn't done that, Ferran Adria said that he and all the other chefs in the world would be, I think the words he used were chasing the dragon of Chinese cuisine. And it's certainly true that until about two decades ago, when I first went to study in China, the country was pretty insular, pretty closed. They had a century of terrible political convulsions, revolution, civil war, famine, cultural revolution, and so on. And all of these things had an impact on all aspects of Chinese culture, including restaurant culture and gastronomy. And so, throughout the 60s and 70s, there were food shortages and rationing, and restaurant culture had been sort of seen as being bourgeois and decadent and corrupt. And so there'd been all kinds of political pressures. So Chinese food was in a bit of a sorry state. And I think that's another reason that that it's been very neglected by the sort of arbiters of global gastronomy, that, until recently it was actually difficult to see, Chinese cuisine in its full glory.
And do you think that moving forward, that Chinese food will garner more deserved attention? Because I feel like there's a difference between Western chefs going there and learning and then taking those things back versus cuisine becoming more of a revered profession in China and building it from within.
Yeah, well, I suppose, I think it's partly makes a sort of cultural problems. But I think that very sophisticated culinary culture, it's not just about what food tastes like, it's about the context and so on. Just to give an example, Heston Blumenthal, his famous fat duck restaurant in Britain, that his dishes are very witty and creative. So he used to do a dish, for example, that was sardines on toast ice cream. And in order to kind of get the joke, you have to know that sardines on toast was a sort of cheap supper dish, and that you normally wouldn't possibly have that in a dessert, in an ice cream. And just the same in Chinese cuisine, there's a whole lot of game playing and witticism, and it helps to understand a bit of cultural context. And also, I think it's really difficult for, Westerners, even if they're very, very well versed in Western gastronomy. You know, if you go into a Chinese restaurant, it's very important to order well, to order a selection of dishes that complement each other. And that's quite difficult to do if you don't know the food very well. So, and within China, I suppose that traditionally chefs are rather looked down on. So there are very prestigious and famous gourmets in Chinese culture, often educated gentlemen who had private chefs and were very good eaters and often knew about cookery but didn't necessarily cook themselves. And there has been this kind of cultural divide. So in China, there aren't so many, or there are very few, of the kind of leading, outspoken, famous celebrity chefs that you have in the West, who are the real sort of ambassadors for their cuisines. So in China, there are a few, and I hope that Chinese people will become more and more proud of their food as an amazing culture, and that we'll see more of these people as advocates for Chinese cuisine.
Wonderful. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll be learning more about China with Fuchsia Dunlop.
Until you prove yourself, compared to them, you're not as.
You are listening to Drilled In by Spiral Jetty Club.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
All right, we are back. I'm Brianna Kurtz, and you're listening to Native on Heritage Radio. And today I'm talking to Fuchsia Dunlop about Chinese culture and cuisine. So, Fuchsia, in your book you say, "It is a testament to the diversity of Chinese cuisine that after more than 10 years of dedicated research, I encounter new ingredients and new dishes not only every single time I visit the country, but often every single day." And you were just in China, so where did you go this time and what did you discover on this trip?
Oh, well, I traveled all over this time, but particularly I spent about 10 days in Yunnan in southwest China, which is a really fascinating region. It's one of the most biodiverse regions on Earth and also ethnically very diverse with sort of about more than 50 ethnic minorities. Many interesting things. I tasted wild mushrooms that I've never had before. Yunnan is particularly well known for its wild mushrooms. And also just one delicious salad made of very tender pine needles. Rather an unlikely ingredient.
And did you see anything, what are some trends right now in Chinese food? You have a really funny anecdote in your book about rustic food, which makes me think of very, Brooklyn, but what else is going on there in the food scene?
Well, I suppose, China's had a great many food safety scares and scandals over the last few years, and also has terrible pollution. And so a lot of people are very concerned with green foods and, healthy foods and, from places, or what we'd call sort of organic and free-range ingredients. So, for example, actually in Beijing at the beginning of the trip, I went to this, it's actually a chain of restaurants specializing in the oat pasta of northern Shanxi province. And this restaurant, I believe they don't use any MSG, monosodium glutamate, and they do a lot of interesting pastas and breads made with, not with wheat or rice, but other grains like oats. And they also make a point of serving meat, which they say is from the grasslands, very unpolluted, free-range meat, and a kind of rustic cookery with very delicious sort of cured pork and homemade pickles and things like that. So I think that, as China hurtles along on the path to development and modernization, there is a kind of nostalgia for, old-fashioned food, honest, rustic food, and also ingredients that you can really trust.
Are the farmers having a say in the direction that the cuisine is going based on some of those ingredients that they're investing in?
Well, I mean, one of the problems really is that in the last couple of decades, there's been this mass exodus from the countryside to the cities. And so in a lot of villages, you find just old people and children. And so there's a great risk that a lot of agricultural and culinary lore is being lost. And, I know people, pickle makers and farmers, who, don't have anyone to teach their skills to. And so these skills are being lost. And, someone I know, the amazing, inspirational owner of the Dragonwell Manor restaurant in Hangzhou, who's doing what, you'd call a kind of farm-to-table, a kind of Chez Panisse-style, restaurant, where he personally guarantees that all the ingredients are sourced from, farmers and artisans who are using traditional methods. But he's finding it very difficult because the older generation are becoming too old to work or are just, dying off. And there's not enough being done to pass on their skills. So his dream really is to link up middle-class urban consumers, like your kind of Brooklynite equivalent in China, with these peasant farmers and artisans, so that, the middle-class consumers will pay a bit more to give the farmers a good, decent living for producing safe food and also preserving their country's traditions. But he's, he's a bit of a one-man band, and there aren't very many people like him.
Hmm. And, Obama was just in the country. It's on the cover of all the newspapers and magazines, Chinese-American relations. Is that something that they talk about just as much there as far as the climate change agreements, GMOs, pollution? I'm glad you brought up hygiene. Are those issues that everyday people are talking about as much as we hear about them in the U.S. possibly?
Well, I think, the immediate problems of, wanting to feed your family safely and pollution are just having an instant and immediate impact on everyone. In terms of GMOs, very few people who I've talked to have, made it seem like a very pressing concern. Mm-hmm. And also climate change, I think it's the same as anywhere, that, it's very difficult for people to contemplate making short-term sacrifices, immediate sacrifices, for some sort of rather vague-seeming long-term emergency. So I think people know a bit about these issues, but what's most pressing is pollution and food safety.
And just really quick on the hygiene thing, culturally speaking, are the concerns for hygiene changing the kind of grammar of meals, whereas before you might have kind of more of a family style, whereas now you might have individual servings? Is that actually changing the kind of social interactions at the table?
I would say at a sort of, for most people, no, not at all. Perhaps for an elite, like in some very high-end restaurants, they're starting to do individual plating for that reason, and also because they think it's more elegant, really. And then some people will use gong kuai, sort of shared chopsticks, to take food from the common plates onto their individual rice bowl or plate, rather than using their own chopsticks. So that's maybe a more elegant and refined way of eating. But for the vast masses of people, I mean, people just eat family style mm-hmm. without any obvious and immediate problems.
And just really quick, back to current events. From your experience when you were just recently in the country, are the recent events in Hong Kong having any effect on the mainland or vice versa, as far as food's concerned?
As far as food is concerned, no. Okay. In fact, I don't think it seemed very interesting to most people I was talking to.
Not interesting at all.
Well, I mean, it's not at the top of people's interests, I would say.
Okay.
Certainly not the chefs and food people that I was seeing.
Absolutely. And MSG, you brought it up, so let me just ask, what is your opinion on the controversial topic of MSG?
Well, I think that science has proved rather conclusively that there's nothing inherently bad about MSG. And personally, I see it as being rather in the category of refined salt and refined sugar, which is that, it's a seasoning which, if used judiciously, is useful. But, a definition of junk food really is fat and carbs with a lot of MSG, salt and sugar. So I know very, very good chefs in China who will use a little MSG to enhance the savory flavors of their dishes. But I don't think it should be used as a substitute for good ingredients and proper stocks. And I don't use it in my own cooking and my own recipes.
Okay. So not bad for you, but personal preference.
No, I mean, because I'm trying to enthuse Westerners with the beauty of Chinese cuisine, obviously I'm not going to use it in my own recipes mm-hmm. because it's not necessary. It's not an old-fashioned traditional ingredient. You don't really need it. And a lot of Westerners are very prejudiced against it. But I certainly don't have a problem personally if Chinese chefs want to use it in the course of cooking rather excellent food.
Okay, well, and I'm glad you brought that up about your kind of... I guess let me just ask the question this way. When it comes to Chinese culture and cuisine, do you have a personal mission as far as sharing, communicating, and educating?
Yeah, I mean, that's quite a grand way of putting it, but I suppose that, I mean, I'm very committed to reporting as faithfully as I can from China and sort of writing about, authentic recipes as I find them in China. And I suppose what I want to do is show people in the West who may not realize this that China has the most extraordinary, complex, diverse cuisine in the world, and also that it's really healthy. It's a really delicious and healthy way to eat. Chinese home cooking is totally different from what you think of as American restaurant cooking, which may be very tasty, but often has a lot of deep-fried dishes and heavy sauces. Chinese home cooking makes marvelous use of vegetables and makes vegetables taste so delicious that they're often the thing you want to eat most on the table. So I suppose, I'd like very much to be part of a broader effort to show the Western world the sort of, the amazing and glorious nature of Chinese cuisines.
And what are maybe some dishes from maybe your most recent cookbook that if someone wants to kind of get started with Chinese cuisine, Chinese cooking at home, that are some good dishes to kind of get your feet wet?
Well, a couple of real Sichuan classics, Gong Bao chicken, very different from the Kung Po chicken in American Chinese restaurants, is a fairly quick and easy stir fry, which is utterly delicious. Everyone loves it. And also Mapo Tofu, which is, you can make it with or without meat, but it's a really sensational, spicy dish that's not very difficult to make. But I'd also suggest that people try making a few Chinese salads and simple stir-fried vegetables. Like one lovely dish in my book is blanched spinach in ginger sauce. Very easy to make, very refreshing, very healthy. So I think, start with simple dishes and just see that, Chinese food doesn't have to be complicated. It's not unhealthy. It can be part of a really sort of convenient and wonderful way to live.
And especially in urban centers like New York and other big cities in the U.S. and across the world, you can always find Chinese ingredients, in Chinatowns or in larger kind of ethnic or international stores. So the ingredients are there.
in Chinatowns and also, in farmers markets, in New York, in California. I've been to farmers markets where you can get wonderful Chinese vegetables, very fresh, very delicious.
Well, I think it's come out, obviously, as much as you are a cook, you are a writer. So what is life like these days? What are you working on?
Working on various projects. There will be further books at some point. Mm-hmm. I'm always writing. I come back from each trip with notebooks full of recipes and stories and so on. So I'm working on a couple of ideas at the moment.
And where can people keep track of you or find out more?
Oh, well, I have a blog, which is www.fuchsiadunlop.com. And I'm also on Twitter at Fuchsia Dunlop and on Instagram, where I post pictures of my cooking and my trips to China. So lots of rather amazing ingredients that I come across and so on.
Yes, I suggest that anyone definitely check out the Instagram from your most recent trip. The pictures were amazing. I don't think I've ever seen tofu quite in so many forms. It's very fascinating. So thank you so much, Yusuf, for joining me today. I really appreciate it and look forward to continuing to look at your articles and books as they come out. That is all for Native this week. Next week is Thanksgiving. I hope everyone has a wonderful holiday, and we will see you back here in December. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.